my intentions to remain strictly in the style of Brahms and not to go further than he himself would have gone if he lived today, to watch carefully all the laws to which Brahms obeyed and not to violate them, which are only known to musicians educated in his environments. Thus spake Arnold Schoenberg in the manifesto regarding his orchestration of the Brahms Piano Quartet No. 1, Opus 25. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this is a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for the Brahms Schoenberg Piano Quartet. Piano quartets are funny things. If you ask people who aren't familiar with the form, they would most likely say they're works for four pianos. Makes sense to me. Aficionados of chamber music would roll their eyes at such literalism and quickly correct you in the nicest way possible, hopefully, that we are talking about a work for piano and string trio being a violin, a viola, and a cello. It's actually a fantastic medium that allows for all sorts of fabulous sounds and combinations. If you're looking for examples, Mozart wrote two truly great ones. Beethoven wrote three, but their juvenilia, having been written when LVB was all of 15. Mendelssohn wrote three piano quartets, but they too are among his very early compositions. On the other hand, Robert Schumann's piano quartet from 1842, his amazing year of chamber music, is a mature masterpiece and was probably one of the inspirations for Johannes Brahms to write his own. The Brahms' first piano quartet, Opus 25, was begun in 1856 and finished in 1861. These were difficult and challenging years for the composer. In 1856, Brahms' mentor Robert Schumann died at the Mendel Institute in Endenich from tertiary syphilis. Schumann had committed himself 2 years earlier, leaving Clara alone to take care of their seven children. Brahms did his best to help on the home front, and in the process probably fell in love with Clara. Who wouldn't? She was beautiful, brilliant, and one of the finest concert pianists in Europe. One can only imagine the intense guilt and confusion Brahms must have felt after Robert's death. Whether anything romantic actually happened between the two is still unsure, but what resulted was a lifelong friendship and musical collaboration. Musically, Brahms was also in a transitional place. All you have to do is look at what he was writing in Opus Numbers 1 through 24, and you get a great idea of what he was trying to achieve. Most of the pieces are for solo piano. There is a piano concerto, two serenades for orchestra, a string sextet, and a piano trio. Brahms was using the medium of chamber music to find his way to symphonic forms. In fact, his Piano Quartet No. 1 often feels like a chamber piece that's just dying to be a symphony. The work was premiered in Brahms' native city of Hamburg in 1861 with Clara Schumann at the piano, and the following year, on November 16, 1862, Brahms played it himself in Vienna with members of the Helmesberger Quartet. In fact, it was Brahms' first musical venture in the city that would eventually become his home and he would be synonymous with. Fast forward 35 years, a 22-year-old composer named Arnold Schoenberg writes his first string quartet. The work is shown to Johannes Brahms, who sadly will die from liver cancer on April 3rd of 1897. Brahms is impressed enough to meet the young, self-taught, and aspiring composer and offers to financially support his education at the Vienna Conservatory. While Schoenberg is too proud to accept the offer, he never forgot Brahms' generosity. In fact, if you'll permit me a sidebar, this was not the first example of Brahms being generous to a talented younger colleague. It was Brahms who helped the struggling Antonín Dvořák by recommending he be given a government stipend in order that he have time for composition. Brahms also introduced Dvořák to his publisher Simrock, and the rest, after the publication of the Slavonic Dances, as they say, is history. Fast forward another 40 years, it's 1937, and Arnold Schoenberg, who has now relocated to Los Angeles, decides to orchestrate the Brahms Piano Quartet No. 1. His reasons for doing so were spelled out in a letter to the San Francisco Chronicle music critic Alfred Frankenstein. Yes, that was his real name, and yes, probably life in the schoolyard was not the most fun. And this is what he said. This is what Arnold Schoenberg said. 1. I like the piece. 2. It is seldom played. 3. It is always very badly played, because the better the pianist, the louder he plays, and you hear nothing from the strings. This is totally true, mes petits amis. I have heard this happen myself. 4. I wanted for once to hear everything, and this, with my transcription, I have achieved. As mentioned before, Brahms is practically symphonic in his ambitions with regard to the Piano Quartet No. 1. The work is in four movements, and the first is in sonata form. The well-behaved sonata form contains three large sections, an exposition where we meet the themes, a development where they are altered, and a recapitulation where we meet them again. There's nothing well-behaved about this first movement. In this early work, Opus 25, Brahms is trying all sorts of radical ideas which would have been seen by his contemporaries as unusual. In fact, his great friend and colleague, the Hungarian violinist Josef Joachim, for whom he wrote the violin concerto, found this movement to be, quote, undisciplined. To the music, mes petits amis. Brahms uses 4.5 or maybe 5 themes in this first movement. Let's get to know them and also get to know how Schoenberg orchestrates them. Here is theme 1. It's a 4-bar melody in G minor, and it's in straightforward quarter notes. It's a serious theme written by a serious man. In fact, the first 4 notes of the theme are going to inform most of this movement. Let's just take a second and see how Schoenberg has orchestrated the theme. He begins with 3 clarinets, the high E-flat, the regular B-flat, and the bass clarinet. By the way, would Brahms ever orchestrate like this? Not a chance. Then the strings take over for 2 bars, then the horn for 1, and then back to the strings. It's so fabulous, here it is again. Now that Brahms has introduced theme 1, the usual course would be to either elaborate on it or to have some kind of transition section away from it. Instead, Brahms changes the key to B-flat major and, without warning, introduces theme 2. Now we have the transitional section using theme 1 material we should have had before. Theme 2 is now but a memory. Theme 3, which is introduced by the cello. Brahms also uses the cello in the original piano quartet, by the way. It's a nice, saddish tune in D minor. The next theme is basically theme 3, but in D major instead of D minor. Let's be generous and call it theme 4. Schoenberg uses oboes and clarinets. Theme 5 is marked animato. It's fantastically majestic and belongs to the strings. Brahms uses the four-note idea from Theme 1 to wrap up the exposition, note that the orchestration changes with each iteration. It also sounds a lot like a development section. Now, in a well-behaved sonata form, we would normally repeat the exposition. Brahms decides to have his cake and eat it too. He repeats only the first few bars and fakes us out, as if it would be a real repeat, but it's actually not. Then we hear theme 2, but the clue that this is not a repeat of the exposition is that theme 2 is now in a minor key. Listen here as Brahms develops theme 1 and Schoenberg processes it through a kaleidoscope of instruments. Brahms spends the development on theme 1, so when he begins the recapitulation, he starts with theme 2, highly unusual but very clever. We skip theme 3 in its minor key and move directly to its major key alter ego, theme 4. Here's theme 5, which before was so animated, is now reduced to winds and a very busy bassoon. The movement ends darkly with a sense of resignation. Brahms' original plan for the second movement was to call it a scherzo. Instead, he decided to use a slower tempo and call the movement an intermezzo. It was a title he would use many times during his career for lyrical movements. The movement is in ternary form, meaning there's an A section, followed by a contrasting B section, and then the A section is repeated. Here's the beginning of the A section. Schoenberg has the oboe together with the English horn for the melody, while the second violins play repeated eighth notes underneath. The contrasting middle or B section is a bit faster and marked animato and has the melody in the strings while the winds play some beautiful filigree around it. The third movement is an early example of the kind of exquisite slow movements Brahms wrote his whole life. This movement is also in ternary or ABA form, with A being an andante lyrical section and B being a rather peculiar march. We begin with a tune that's so beautiful and majestic you wish you'd written it yourself. Schoenberg gives it to some very majestic strings. When the melody is restated, Schoenberg deftly moves it to the winds and brass. Suddenly, a rhapsody is interrupted by some staccato repeated notes. Watson, something is afoot! What's afoot is the B section march. It reminds me of the Turkish march in the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It's also odd to have a march in triple time, and yet here it is. Listen for Schoenberg's wonderful use also of percussion, something Brahms would never do. In its next iteration, the march grows louder, more brash, and has lots of snare drum. Once the march finally exhausts itself, our A theme returns, but this time in a beautiful solo oboe. Finally, we get to hear the theme in some beautiful Rachmaninoff-like strings. Brahms was once asked at a society party, "How do you write such beautiful adagios?" He replied, "My publisher orders them up that way." The last movement is marked Rondo alla Zingarese, Gypsy Rondo. Having grown up in the port city of Hamburg, Brahms was very familiar and fond of Hungarian/Gypsy music. In the years following the unsuccessful revolution of 1848, many Hungarians moved to Hamburg either en route elsewhere or took up residence in the North German city. Brahms was a friend and collaborator with two famous Hungarian violinists. Edo Remenyi was a gypsy violinist who briefly toured with Brahms in 1853, and Josef Joachim, one of the most important violinists of the 19th century, was a lifelong friend. This is Brahms' first piece in the Hungarian/Gypsy style, but it wouldn't be his last. In addition to the 21 Hungarian Rhapsodies, we also have the third movement of the Violin Concerto, which was written for Joachim. Rondos are pieces based on departure and return. We have a central theme, which we will call A, and many departures and returns do indeed occur in this relatively short and frankly viscerally exciting movement. It's full of vim and vigor. Here's the principal theme A. Here's our first departure. In contrast to the earthy theme A, B is smooth and crystalline. I especially like the triangle. This next departure feels like an all-expense-paid trip to beautiful downtown Budapest. How about this fabulous section, full of real Hungarian schmaltz and grooviness? Toward the end of the movement, Brahms has a cadenza which in the original he gives to the piano. Schönberg gives it to the clarinet, an instrument which is a part of the standard gypsy band. Then we have some moments of supreme poignance. And finally, theme A takes us home. So what is indeed great about the Brahms Piano Quartet No. 1, Opus 25, and also the Arnold Schönberg Orchestration? Let's start with the Brahms. Even though this is a sprawling, youthful work of eccentricities that Brahms would smooth out in later compositions, it's full of fabulous ideas which delight the ear and the mind. It's no surprise that Joachim found it undisciplined. It is, so what? 2. It's a grand and glorious journey. Though Brahms wouldn't write a symphony until 15 years later, this piece contains some amazing melodic and rhythmic ideas. To be blunt, mes petits amis, early pieces by Brahms are probably better than mature pieces by most other composers. 3. Arnold Schönberg was an amazing orchestrator. Dare I say it, he was probably a greater orchestrator than Brahms himself. By expanding the orchestra and using many instruments that Brahms never used or even thought about, he created something new and something wonderful. The fact that Schönberg admired Brahms is obvious from the first bar to the last. I mentioned earlier that Brahms was impressed by the young Arnold Schönberg and wished to help him financially. It's obvious that Schönberg was eternally grateful for the offer and paid him back in the most perfect way possible. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this has been a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for the Brahms Piano Quartet No. 1, Opus 25, in the orchestration by Arnold Schönberg.